Welcome to the Lancet Respiratory Medicine Podcast. I'm Aaron Van Dorn. Today on the podcast, I spoke with Dr. Christopher Breitling, Professor of Respiratory Medicine at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom, one of the authors on the CASCADE study, which explored the mechanism of action in tezepelumab in improving clinical outcomes in patients with moderate to severe uncontrolled asthma. Dr. Breitling, tezepelumab blocks TSLP from interacting with its receptor. What are the downstream effects of this, and how can we measure these effects?
So TSLP, or thymic stromal lymphopoietin, is an epithelial-derived cytokine, and we know that it activates a number of inflammatory and structural cells, including promoting T cell polarization to Th2 cells and also activation of innate lymphoid cells, as well as other important cells such as the mast cell. In so doing, it then promotes the release of type 2 cytokines, which in turn can then lead to an increase in eosinophils in the airway and isotype switching of the B cells to release upregulation of IgE. We also know that important type 2 cytokines such as IL-13 can lead to a promotion of exhaled nitric oxide release from the epithelium. So why have I focused on those aspects of the biology of TSLP? It's because they allow us to then measure things that then actually can help us understand the biological response. So it means that we can then measure eosinophils in the blood, we can measure exhaled nitric oxide in breath, and we can measure total IgE. And we know that treatment with tezepelumab has downstream effects because it actually decreases each of those biomarkers.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the CASCADE study and its aims and how you carried it out?
The CASCADE study is a mechanistic experimental medicine study that complemented the phase 3 program for tezepelumab in severe asthma. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to really get some insights into the mechanism of action. So we wanted to look at airway inflammatory cells, we wanted to look at airway remodeling. Importantly, we wanted to also focus on airway hyperresponsiveness. We chose to look at patients with moderate to severe uncontrolled asthma, and it was a large study. So we actually recruited just under 60 patients in each arm, and it was a parallel group study over a 24-week period with a single dose of tezepelumab versus placebo.
What did you find?
So what we wanted to look at primarily was the inflammatory cell numbers, and what was really striking was the reduction in the eosinophil numbers in the submucosa or the lamina propria. So there was nearly a sevenfold reduction in eosinophil numbers. In contrast, though, when we looked at the other cell types, and this included neutrophils, T cells that were either that were CD3 or CD4 positive, and mast cells by measuring tryptase or kinase positive cells. But those other cell types didn't change significantly in response to tezepelumab versus placebo. So the most striking response in terms of tissue changes was the eosinophil numbers. We were also struck by the changes in the biomarkers. So again, we were able to identify a reduction in blood eosinophils and the FeNO. And then when we were looking at the response in terms of the airway hyperresponsiveness, that we also showed that there was an improvement in the mannitol challenge, such that there was a reduction in airway hyperresponsiveness in response to tezepelumab versus placebo. And this is a really striking feature of the study.
Why do you think that there was a significant effect on eosinophil concentration, but not on neutrophil, T cell, or mast cell concentrations? What are the implications of these findings?
So it's quite an intriguing observation in the fact that we know that there's a number of effects of TSLP on the airway, but clearly the cell that changed profoundly was the eosinophil numbers. What we don't know yet, and is still under study, is whether there are changes in the inflammatory cell numbers in different compartments in the airway. So in the CASCADE study, we first reported what we see in the submucosa, also known as the lamina propria, but we're now also looking at cell numbers in the epithelial layer and also in the smooth muscle bundle. And I think this will be important when we're then linking it to the other effect, airway hyperresponsiveness. We also are now looking at activation markers and other features of remodeling in the same airway samples. And I think that will really start to shed light upon whether tezepelumab has a broader effect than we've seen so far on inflammation, which thus far has been restricted to its impact on eosinophils in the tissue.
Another important finding was the change from baseline in airway hyperresponsiveness to mannitol, a pre-specified exploratory endpoint. Could you please explain why that is?
We were interested to look at this because it's an important feature of asthma. We know that airway hyperresponsiveness is a feature in terms of its diagnosis, but also in terms of them being able to understand the impact of airway lability in response to challenges. In an early study of tezepelumab in mild disease, we identified that there was improvements in airway hyperresponsiveness to methacholine challenge, which is a direct spasmogen of the smooth muscle. So that was a study published in the New England Journal by Gavreau and colleagues. So in this cascade study, we looked at mannitol, and the mannitol challenge works in a slightly different way. It's an indirect challenge. So it's an osmotic challenge that we know has effects particularly on mast cells and mast cell degranulation. We've previously shown that mast cells located in the airway smooth muscle are important in association with airway hyperresponsiveness. And one of the interesting things to investigate further is whether there are changes in mast cell number, mast cell phenotype, or mast cell activation in the airway smooth muscle bundle. And this will be of particular interest in our future investigation. But I was particularly struck by the finding of the response to AHR in this moderate to severe uncontrolled asthma population. And I think it's likely that this has an impact on the clinical efficacy that's being found in phase three.
How do the cascade study results fit in with other studies of tezepelumab, such as Navigator and Source studies for asthma?
So the Navigator study was the pivotal phase three study looking primarily at exacerbation frequency in severe asthma. And that showed that there was a reduction in exacerbations in the whole population. And interestingly, there was benefit in terms of exacerbation reduction, both in those that had high or low eosinophils or high or low T2 immunity determined by their exhaled nitric oxide. So the cascade study then starts to provide some explanations for the rationale for why the Navigator study was positive. It clearly shows that there's a profound effect on tissue eosinophils in addition to what's been shown in terms of blood eosinophil reductions. And it's likely that this is driving some of the impact on the clinical benefits shown in Navigator for exacerbations, but also possibly for other features such as lung function and asthma control and health status. But I think this is where the airway hyperresponsiveness data is also going to be very important to consider, because this might also be contributing to some of those benefits that are seen in the Navigator trial. It'll be important to then try and correlate findings that are in the cascade study that we report here, but also in the subsequent analysis that we do from the biopsies from this study, to see if we can unpick further the reasons why we're seeing the benefits that are in the Navigator study. The Source study so far is not published. It's been presented as an abstract at the American Thoracic Society, and this was looking at a prednisone-dependent population and looking at reducing oral corticosteroids. And I think it's more complex to then consider cascade in that setting, as that's a specific study looking at the response to reducing oral corticosteroids. And I think it would be important to see that study in its entirety and then try and understand how cascade and Source then perhaps link together.
What do you advise is the best approach for people who are naive to biologics?
So this question really relates to how do you manage severe asthma per se, and always the first things to consider is making sure that you've secured the diagnosis, you've optimized therapy, you've treated any comorbidities, ensured adherence, and observed the patient and optimized the therapy. But at that point, when you're then considering biologics, the current guidelines really focus on those patients with T2 inflammation, which is important with current licensed biologics. But it will be important to then think about the positioning of tezepelumab, which will become, I think, clearer after potential licensing, and then thinking about where it positions into guidelines. Cascade doesn't specifically address that issue because it's a mechanistic study rather than a pivotal trial, but it does start to help to understand some of the mechanisms that are driving benefit in the Navigator and the phase 3 trials.
What does the future hold for tezepelumab in relation to other biologic therapies for asthma?
Again, I think this is a really important question, but one that can't be answered by Cascade. But the data from the Navigator study does suggest that there's benefits in both those who have high or low eosinophils or high or low FeNO, as I alluded to earlier. And I think this is going to be a really important consideration when we're thinking about how do we then position these therapies. And clearly that's something that's going to be considered carefully by the regulators, and it will also be considered carefully by the different healthcare providers in different countries and regions.
Do you think that COVID-19 and its treatment, for example, corticosteroids, had any effect on the study enrollment or its results?
So I'll take each of those in turn because they're quite distinct. So COVID-19 has obviously impacted on us all. And when it comes to studies, then clearly a bronchoscopy study is a concern during a pandemic. How do you complete a bronchoscopy study safely? How do you manage the logistics? I think what worked incredibly well with the Cascade study is the majority of the data had been collected before the pandemic, but patients who were still on the study then had extensions of the therapy beyond the original 24 weeks, and then the bronchoscopy and other endpoints were then delayed. And I don't think this adversely affected the design of the study. I think quite to the contrary, it actually was a real credit to the centres and the sponsors to actually be able to deliver such a large bronchoscopy study in such difficult circumstances. So I don't think that affected the outcomes in any adverse way. I think it simply just was meant that it was a challenge to deliver. In terms of treatments, I think this is an important consideration. When we're thinking about phase 3 studies, we're then looking at patients who have high frequency of exacerbations, have the greatest unmet need, and then enter into a efficacy trial to really show response in terms of clinical endpoints. When you're doing a mechanistic study such as Cascade with bronchoscopy, which itself has safety considerations for patients, then you still want to be able to study patients that have moderate to severe disease, but you then introduce inclusion and exclusion criteria, which then minimize risk to the patient. So you exclude patients who have very high frequency of exacerbations, for example. And in so doing, although I feel the findings are generalizable to a study population, it may be that we actually underestimate some of the findings that you might have seen in a more severe, uncontrolled population that would perhaps be more reflective of the kinds of patients that we would treat in the real world. So in some ways that makes the findings even more striking, the fact that we were able to see a 7-fold reduction in tissue eosinophils and an improvement in airway hyperresponsiveness in a bronchoscopy study, I think really underscores the fact that these effects are really quite profound. And I think there may be other findings that might be uncovered as we look into the biopsies and the data in more detail.
Dr. Breitling, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks very much.